From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In a society in which a high-ranking U.S. senator compares homosexuality to sex with dogs and sex with children, it's not surprising that there were 12 anti-gay murders last year.
Department of Justice or obstruction of justice? The man who's supposed to enforce the nation's civil rights laws, Attorney General John Ashcroft, has banned a gay pride event within the DOJ. And the battle for the Supreme Court has begun. Chief Justice William Rehnquist and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor could resign within this term. Will the new court overturn women's right to choose, among other issues? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A top leader from the Palestinian group Hamas has been wounded in an assassination attempt by Israeli forces. Agence France-Presse reports Israeli helicopter gunships fired missiles this morning at a car driven by Abdulaziz Arantisi in Gaza City. A five-year-old girl and a woman were killed. 25 others were injured. The attack comes at a particularly sensitive time, as Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen is attempting to bring Hamas back to the negotiating table in order to implement the U.S.-backed so-called roadmap to peace. The BBC is reporting it was Arantisi who last week announced Hamas was withdrawing from the talks with Abu Mazen. Hamas has said one of the conditions it demanded to halt violence is an end to Israeli-targeted killings. A senior aide to Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, Nabil Abu Dana, told Reuters today, quote, "This is a grave step. This shows Israel's determination to abort the roadmap." Israeli forces also destroyed 13 homes in northern Gaza town of Beit Hanun. The moves come 2 days after the three main Palestinian militant groups joined forces to an attack in Israeli army outpost in the Gaza Strip, killing 4 Israeli soldiers. A 5th was killed in a second attack on the West Bank. It was the first Palestinian attack since the Prime Minister Abu Mazen met with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and President Bush in Jordan for the peace summit. Abu Mazen's facing fierce criticism for giving too much while demanding too little. Meanwhile, The Guardian of London reports Israeli settlers continue to protest against Ariel Sharon's decision to dismantle some illegal Jewish outposts in the West Bank. In Amona, hundreds of settlers attempted to block Israeli soldiers from tearing down homes there. While Sharon has announced plans to dismantle 15 outposts, only 4 of them are inhabited with residents. The Associated Press is reporting the U.S. military units assigned to track down Iraqi weapons of mass destruction have run out of places to look and are getting time off or being assigned to other duties. Lieutenant Colonel Keith Harrington, whose team has been cut by more than 30%, said, "It doesn't appear there are any more targets at this time. We're hanging around with no missions in the foreseeable future." AP reports over the past week, several teams have been taken off assignment completely. Rather than visit suspected weapons sites, they're brushing up on target practice and catching up on writing letters home. The Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency is expected to be sent in to take over the inspections jobs once its 1,300-person Iraq survey group takes over. This comes as pressure mounts on President Bush to explain why no banned arms have been found. For the second time in recent days, Bush said yesterday he's, quote, "absolutely convinced the U.S. will find proof that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction." UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, is reporting the number of children in Iraq suffering from diarrhea and related diseases appears to have risen dramatically in the past year. Cholera, dysentery, and typhoid were 2.5 times higher this May than a year earlier. The World Food Program said that before the U.S.-led invasion, 1 million Iraqi children had been malnourished as a result of diarrhea. But the war and the collapse of Iraq's infrastructure has worsened the health hazards, disrupting clean water supplies, damaging sewage systems, and halting rubbish collections. North Korea threatened yesterday to build nuclear weapons as a deterrent to what it calls a, quote, hostile U.S. policy. The Associated Press reports the government's first public declaration of its nuclear ambitions. North Korea also, for the first time, linked its nuclear efforts to rebuilding its failing economy. Three U.S. immigration agents were convicted yesterday of violating the civil rights of a Mexican immigrant who died after his neck was broken in a 2001 INS raid in Texas. Serafin Olvera Carrera, a 48-year-old father of five, was handcuffed and forced to lie face down on the floor while one of the agents kneed him forcefully in the back, leaving him paralyzed. When Olvera complained, the agents thought he was faking an injury, and they proceeded to pepper spray him. He didn't receive treatment for 7 more hours. 3 immigration officials now face up to 20 years in prison. The White House is urging House Republicans to increase the child tax credit for 6.5 million low-income families. This comes following a heated dispute over the omission of the poor in the tax bill that Bush signed last month. The FBI yesterday oversaw the draining of a Maryland pond in a search for evidence in the 2001 anthrax attacks. The pond is located 8 miles from Fort Detrick, the military site where bioterrorism expert Stephen Hatfield used to work. Hatfield has been identified by officials as a, quote, person of interest in the case. He's denied any involvement. And Usman Zango, the African immigrant shot dead by a plainclothes officer in New York, was buried in his native country on Monday. This according to an attorney for his family. Zango was remembered as someone who tried to provide for his family and others in his village, sending money for books, medicine, and food. The funeral was attended by Zango's wife, children, and other family members. Zango was shot 4 times on May 22nd by a New York City police officer guarding counterfeit merchandise seized during a raid on a warehouse in Manhattan. Zango was unarmed. He'd been visiting the rented storage unit where he repaired African craftwork and drums. He was shot after a winding chase through the facility's hallways. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office was investigating the shooting. Remains unclear why the chase began. Again, Usman Zango buried in his home country of Burkina Faso. John Coltrane, Iris, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. June is Gay Pride Month. Every year, hundreds of thousands of lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, and transgendered people participate in marches, parades, and other events around the world. Gay Pride harkens back over 30 years to June 1969. It was the height of the civil rights era. For more than a decade, African Americans and other oppressed groups had been openly standing up to and fighting against their oppressors. But gay people around the country were still quietly putting up with police raids on gay venues, harassment, and discrimination. All of this changed one night in June 1969 when New York City police officers raided a gay bar called Stonewall. Historian Lillian Faderman describes the scene to 100 working-class patrons of the bar, including drag queens, third-world gay men, and a handful of butch lesbians started to riot. Their numbers doubled and soon increased tenfold. The riots continued. The following night, fires were started all over the neighborhood. The first gay riots in history became known as the Stonewall Rebellion. It was the birth of a movement. Today, gay men, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgendered people are still regularly ridiculed, discriminated against, harassed, and murdered. The instigators range from passers-by in the street to the highest levels of government. Last week, the man in charge of enforcing civil rights, Attorney General John Ashcroft, banned a gay pride event organized by some 200 Justice Department employees. Agency workers have held pride events for years, including last year when John Ashcroft's number two official, Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, spoke to about 150 employees. But then conservative groups lobbied Ashcroft to ban the event this year. Now, Justice Department officials have told the DOJ Pride Group it can't hold the event at the department's Pennsylvania Avenue building later this month because of a new policy prohibiting events not recognized by White House proclamation. President Bush has issued hundreds of presidential proclamations recognizing African American History Month in February, National Prayer Day. Bush declared June National Home Ownership Month. White House spokesperson Scott McClellan said, quote, "The president believes everybody ought to be treated with dignity and respect, but he does not believe we should be politicizing people's sexual orientation." Well, Leonard Hirsch is on the phone with us. He's president of the Federal GLOBE, which stands for Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Employees of the Federal Government. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, can you tell us about the banning of the DOJ Pride event?
We find this extraordinarily unfortunate and a backsliding of what had been a slow but steady movement toward inclusion of the LGBT or lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community into the federal workforce as respected and honored parts of the community. But I do want to say that we still haven't seen anything in paper. All of this is verbal. We've requested, or DOJ Pride has requested from the Attorney General's office, the policy and the reasoning in writing, and they have yet not received anything.
Does that mean you could possibly hold this event?
I think that there are increasing pressures, and I thank you for having us on here to include that on the department to change what has been said and to allow the event to occur. If not, we are certainly looking at other venues in Washington to be able to have the DOJ Pride event.
Perhaps since while President Bush has not recognized Gay Pride Month, the month of June, but he has recognized this as National Homeownership Month. You could be celebrating gay men and lesbians who own homes in the Department of Justice.
That's an interesting angle on it. I think we can look at that. But I think it is much more important to keep the stand and say that as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender employees of the federal government, that we are owed the same respect and the same treatment and equal access to facilities as every other group, including homeowners.
We're talking to Leonard Hirsch, who is with president of Federal Globe, again, the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender employees of the federal government. Has the White House made a comment on this? How high has this controversy gone at this point?
We have not heard anything in this iteration, in the last week, from the White House. There have been communications with the White House, of course, and so far we have not heard anything back. I do find it ironic that the White House's statement on why they're not putting out a Pride proclamation last year and this year is because they did not want to politicize sexual orientation. Of course, the irony is that by not putting it out, they are specifically politicizing sexual orientation as one of the only issues that they are not putting out a proclamation, as you so rightly showed before. They are making this much more of a political issue than it needed to be.
Well, you have within the Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division. Interestingly, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force has released the largest ever study of harassment of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender students, faculty, and staff on college campuses. The study found more than one in three LGBT undergraduate students have experienced anti-gay harassment within the past year. We're also joined in our studio by Sean Cahill, who's director of the Policy Institute of National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. Can you tell us more about this report?
Sure. This is the largest ever study of gay, lesbian, bi, and trans people on campus. And we found a significant level of people who've experienced harassment within the past 12 months. Transgender people on campus were more likely than other people who were gay, lesbian, or bisexual to have experienced harassment. About 43% of respondents said that their campus was homophobic. So compared to earlier studies in the 80s and early 90s, there's a significant improvement. Back then, as many as 70-80% of people had been harassed in the last 12 months, and now it's down to, you know, about a third. But that said, the universities that we surveyed are among the most gay-supportive universities in the country. They have a LGBT campus center. They have domestic partner benefits for employees. They have a sexual orientation non-discrimination policy. So we think this is really just the tip of the iceberg, and that on the average U.S. college campus, things are probably a little bit worse than what this report
depicts. Can you give us some examples of what has transpired?
Well, there was recently a murder in Newark, an anti-gay murder, in which a 15-year-old lesbian was on her way home after a night of hanging out with her friends, was waiting for the bus.
What was her name?
Sakia Gunn. And they were hit on by some guys about twice their age. Sakia made the mistake of telling them not to waste their time because they were gay. And the men freaked out, attacked them, and ended up stabbing and killing Sakia Gunn. Last year, there were 12 anti-gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender murders in the U.S. that we know about. The year before that, there were 10. There are close to 2,000 incidents of harassment or violence against LGBT people in this country in the past year. So this is a widespread phenomenon, and this is only what we know about. It's not mandatory that every jurisdiction in this country report these things. So this is sort of the extreme manifestation of homophobia. But I think it really starts at the top, you know, like I said at the top of the hour, in a society in which the third most powerful U.S. senator compares homosexuality to bestiality and pedophilia. You're creating a climate in which those kinds of acts are conceivable.
What about that comment of Senator Rick Santorum? Clarence Patton, also joining us on the phone, acting executive director of the Anti-Violence Project.
I think that what we see in Senator Santorum's comments and comments of congressmen and other senators before him is those are the elements that contribute to the atmosphere that actually facilitates anti-LGBT harassment and violence. When you see your leadership saying such things, comparing homosexuality to bestiality and incest, What it really says to people who would act on their prejudices and hatred is that it's actually okay to act on those things and to act on those things violently. It's unfortunate that even though, you know, Santorum is only the latest, the fact is that Santorum is the last in a long line of people in Washington saying such things, whether it's Dick Armey calling Barney Fagg, certainly other folks. And
just to clarify for people, Dick Armey, this was several years ago, who at the time was number two man in the House under Newt Gingrich, when doing an interview one morning with a group of radio reporters, said Frank, and later he said he hadn't had his coffee yet when he made that comment.
Exactly. So, you know, those folks really set the climate, and I think what we see with this Justice Department thing is only another element in really laying the groundwork for maintaining a culture that accepts that LGBT people are in fact less than, less worthy, and really available for victimization. And what's really reprehensible about this is that with the Department of Justice, this really does represent a rolling back of acceptance rights availability that these folks at the DOJ have had now for quite some time under this new administration. And that's really both unfortunate and for those folks working at the DOJ, I think, quite terrifying.
We have to break. We'll come back with Clarence Patton, Acting Executive Director of the Anti-Violence Project, Sean Cahill, Director of Policy Institute, National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, as well as Leonard Hirsch, who is President of Federal Globe. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
That is not what I do. I ain't no damsel in distress, and I don't need to be rescued. So put me down, punk. Wouldn't you prefer a maid in fear? Isn't there a kitten stuck up a tree somewhere? But it seems like I've got everyone fooled. Every time I say something they find hard to hear, they chalk it up to my anger and never to their own fear. Imagine you're a girl.
Johnny DeFranco here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about what happened at the Department of Justice, Attorney General John Ashcroft, the chief civil rights enforcer in this country, banning a gay pride event that's supposed to be happening in just over a week at the Department of Justice. We're talking to Leonard Hirsch, who is head of Federal Globe, which stands for Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Employees of the Federal Government, as well as Clarence Patton with the Anti-Violence Project, and in the studio, Sean Cahill, Director of the Policy Institute, National Gay Lesbian Task Force. Sean Cahill, what did Trent Lott say several years ago as Clarence Patton is going through the comments made by politicians?
Right. In July of 98, there was a full-page ad in the New York Times and other newspapers saying that gay people can change, that we can become straight with counseling or accepting Jesus as our savior or whatever it is. And Trent Lott was interviewed about it, and he defended it, and then he compared homosexuality to kleptomania and alcoholism, and he said it was a mental illness like an addiction or inability to control yourself from stealing things in a mm-hmm. department store.
Speaking of politicians, you have also done an analysis of the Democratic candidates running for president.
That's right. We put out a report, which is on our website at www.ngltf.org, looking at the Democratic candidates for president on 11 issues of concern to our community. And what we found is that this is the most pro-LGBT group of candidates running for the nomination of a major political party in U.S. presidential history. So all nine of the declared candidates support non-discrimination laws, including sexual orientation. All of them support HIV and AIDS prevention. Most of them support domestic partnership, lifting the military ban. Most support civil unions, which afford a form of equality, a separate form of equality at the level of state policy. So it's a dramatic improvement over the last time we had an open Democratic primary in 1992, when even Bill Clinton, who turned out to be a very pro-gay president, his position on non-discrimination laws was not clear in the 92 election. Compared to the current occupant of the White House, there's just no comparison. On these 11 issues, President Bush, we know, is opposed on 8 of them. He's opposed to non-discrimination laws. He's opposed to hate crimes laws. He's opposed to marriage and adoption. And on the other 3 issues, we don't know how he stands, but we assume that he's not supportive. Gender identity, non-discrimination, Social Security, survivor benefits, and gay supportive education policy. He hasn't taken a position on those, but we don't have high hopes.
What about Dick Cheney, the vice president, who has a lesbian daughter?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the policy of this administration, we haven't seen that have a great impact. I think, I was hopeful at the exchange that he had with Senator Lieberman in the vice presidential debate about marriage and about partner recognition, but we haven't seen it translate into policy. So on the one hand, we have the Democrats debating what form of partner recognition is most appropriate. Should it be civil unions? Should it be marriage? 3 of the 9 Democrats support marriage.
Who supports marriage?
Mosley Braun, former Senator Carol Mosley Braun, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and Reverend Al Sharpton. So that's where
Howard
they're
Dean
at.
Howard Dean comes from the, what is it, the only state in the union that recognizes civil unions,
yes. And what he's proposed is that there be federal recognition of civil unions, which would require a very complicated bill, but it would give us equality at the federal level, albeit a separate form of equality, and it would give us equal treatment under immigration policy, Social Security, federal taxes. So that's where the Democrats are at, and the Republicans are debating whether or not to have a gay pride event at a federal agency. There's just no comparison, you know?
What are the other criterion that you judge the Democratic candidates on?
We actually looked at their voting records. We did a Lexis search to find any statements they had made on these issues. And other issues that we looked at included HIV prevention. So, for example, did they support or oppose abstinence only until marriage? There was a vote on this with the Global AIDS bill, in which conservative Republicans attached an amendment to the $15 billion global AIDS bill targeting Africa in particular, saying that any prevention efforts have to, a third of the money for prevention has to promote abstinence only until marriage. Just about all of the Democrats running voted against this. The ones who didn't vote against it spoke out against it. For example, Senator Kerry gave a speech against it and then was out of Washington when the vote actually took place. And the administration is promoting abstinence only until marriage. That's their solution to sexually transmitted diseases and unwanted pregnancy. And we know that that's not an effective solution. Another issue that we looked at is Social Security survivor benefits. Married couples who pay into the system their whole lives, if one of them dies and is not able to enjoy their retirement savings, their widow or widower gets that money, and it provides income security in old age. Same-sex couples don't have that benefit. So we pay into the system. Gay people pay into the system our whole lives. And then if we die, our partner doesn't get the benefits.
You personally were attacked years ago?
Yeah, I think it was 11 or 12 years ago now. My boyfriend and I and a friend of mine were out, and we stopped to get a slice of pizza on the way home, and we were harassed, and we talked back, and then we got physically attacked.
And what happened in that case? Did you report it?
No, we didn't report it.
Do you find that that's most often the case?
I think that's most often the case. I mean, even since I moved to New York 4 years ago, I've had several instances where I've just had things said to me or things said to me and my boyfriend. And I haven't, it's, you know, I should report it, and Clarence tells me to report it, and I have a couple of instances, but I haven't always reported them.
Clarence Patton, can you talk as head of the Anti-Violence Project of the whole continuum from verbal violence and attacks to the most serious murder?
Sure, and I just want to clarify, I'm actually acting executive director of the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs. I don't want the ED of the AVP here in New York to get upset. What we do and our member programs do at NCAVP is really look at just that, the continuum of violence from verbal harassment all the way up to and including murder. And what we found annually we do a report on hate-related violence, and we define violence as encompassing that entire spectrum. Our most recent report came out this April. And it looked at 2002, and it looked at hate-related incidents in 12 areas. And what we found was that although in our survey last year was not the most violent year, so to speak, it was certainly it was essentially an average year for us. But what we discovered was that all in all, in 2002, in just 12 regions of the country that really only represent about an eighth of the United States population, there were about 2,000 incidents. And what's important about that number, because when you think about the entire country, is that it doesn't sound like a lot, is that the that's just slightly more than the FBI tracks for the entire nation. And we know that we are only catching just a small portion of incidents. But in getting into the complexion of the violence, the biggest category of offense tends to be harassment. Most people, the media focuses on murders, which are certainly unfortunate. And as Sean mentioned before, there were 12 in the regions that contributed to our report. But altogether, if you took harassment just as its own category, there were over 2,000 instances of harassment that we saw last year. At the same time, what we've noticed is that even as certain, let's say, lower-level offenses like harassment, even though it remains most common, begin to diminish in some areas. Other things like assault, for instance, is going up, and it's becoming a much larger proportion of incidents across the country. And what we believe to be happening is really a couple of things. One, that even as some progress has been made in terms of really addressing anti-LGBT violence in a lot of areas across the country, whether it's the gay-straight alliances in schools, community education efforts, et cetera, some of the real true believers have essentially redoubled their efforts. The folks who are more likely to commit violent incidents have really stepped things up. And what we see is that now, if you are the victim of an anti-LGBT incident, you're more likely than ever to actually be the victim of an assault as opposed to simple harassment, verbal harassment, telephone harassment, some of the other things. But beyond even assault and harassment, we also do see significant increases in areas such as sexual assault and rape, which for a long time were primarily instances of lesbians being attacked. That was one of the key ways in which attackers really went after lesbians was through sexual violence, but we're increasingly seeing it used as well against men. We also are seeing a lot of increases in, for instance, some of the abductions that we've seen where people have really taken people out of their environments and then abuse them, either increasing or rising over the last several years. We also, over the years, have seen a rise in reports of anti-transgender-related incidents, a lot of that is because a lot of the programs that belong to NCAVP have been much more proficient in recent years at actually reaching out to the transgender community. So what we're seeing is an increase in reports. And last year, we also saw a dramatic increase in reports from young people, which we believe is probably the same thing, where we've really been able to reach out to young people. And it's certainly NGLTF's report about campus violence was not a surprise to us, because it really supported what we had found in the 2002 report.
Clarence Patton, what should people do if they're attacked? Let's say just, the range, but starting with verbal abuse.
Verbal abuse, I think that if people are, and we're certainly talking about New York here, so there are resources, the first thing that people should do is, if they are okay and they're not in need of assistance, is they should actually call to report it. And by that, I don't necessarily mean calling the police. I mean calling the Anti-Violence Project, if you're somewhere else where there is a similar organization, an organization like that. Because those organizations, if you actually choose to take it to the police, can assist you with that, which can be a traumatic experience in the best of times for folks. If it's something more than harassment, i.e., there's some physical threat or injury, then you absolutely, the first thing to do is to actually get to a hospital to make sure that you're actually okay, healthy, and safe. And then you can call for assistance to an anti-violence program. You know, a lot of people wonder why it's important to report these things. You know, some of the best information that we can give to the leaders who will listen to us, as well as to law enforcement, to really change things in communities across the country, has been our ability to prove that this is actually happening. And it sounds strange to have to prove that, you know, all of us know that it happens. But the fact is that the ability to actually show it in black and white in numbers is essential. And what we also find when we do get this information is that, you know, it really bears out the diversity of our community. You know, most people think, oh, my God, it's just, you know, going to be the typical victim is going to be a gay white man who, you know, is middle class or whatever. The fact is that in our report, only about 49%, of victims are actually Caucasian. And so what that means is that we're able to actually capture a real diversity of the community and show that this is something that's impacting all of us, no matter who we are, what our identity is. And it's so important for all of us to be represented and our experiences to be represented in this.
As we wrap up, I wanted to ask Sean Cahill. In our next segment, we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court, the possible retirement of one or two Supreme Court justices. The Chief Justice, William Rehnquist's daughter, has been involved with some controversy targeting AIDS groups. Can you talk about that?
Right. Yeah, Janet Rehnquist, the Chief Justice's daughter, was a special investigator for the Department of Health and Human Services and conducted an audit of all AIDS service organizations in the United States to determine whether or not their prevention strategies violated local standards of pornography. And this was in response to a call by a number of conservative Republican congresspeople for such an investigation. And you know, luckily there hasn't been a defunding of AIDS service organizations as a result of this, and she's since resigned because of some other controversies unrelated to the sort of implicit homophobia of the AIDS audit. But it still had a really devastating impact in terms of creating a self-censorship on the part of AIDS service organizations. People that are trying to do prevention in communities that are where there's very high risk, where they really have to get people's attention. They're now not saying things that they would have said maybe 2 years ago because they're worried about the federal government telling them this is pornographic, we're going to stop funding you. So it's really had a chilling impact, and it's really interfered with HIV prevention. And you've seen, for example, in Seattle recently, some of the highest rates of HIV transmission now in certain age groups that we've seen in 20 years of the epidemic. And I think it's partly as a result of that.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. We've been speaking with Sean Cahill, who is director of the Policy Institute of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, Clarence Patton, who is acting executive director of the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs, and Leonard Hirsch, again, with Federal Globe, DOJ Pride, the gay and lesbian group within the Department of Justice, has been told they cannot hold their annual event, which they have held every year now for years within the Department of Justice celebrating Pride Month. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll look at the battle for the Supreme Court. Stay with us. Are listening to Democracy Now! This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The battle for the Supreme Court has begun. Intense lobbying, including fundraising, advertising, and major research, has begun. A vacancy is expected in the next several weeks. None of the nine justices have said they plan to retire, but analysts are speculating the time is right for a change in at least one, perhaps two seats. The expectations are based on the age of several justices and the general recognition that this is President Bush's last chance to name a justice before the presidential campaign begins. The three oldest judges on the Supreme Court are 78-year-old Chief Justice William Rehnquist, 73-year-old Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and 83-year-old Justice John Paul Stevens. All three are Republican. Abortion rights activists assert that Roe v. Wade, the 1973 decision recognizing a constitutional right to abortion, could be overturned by a substantially refashioned court. The idea is that if justices are going to retire, they should do it in the next month or plan to hold on until after the 2004 elections, essentially committing themselves to two more court terms. White House officials told the New York Times that Rehnquist and O'Connor are likeliest to retire, given the knowledge that a Republican president would choose their successor. In December 2000, Newsweek reported that at an election night party, when U.S. Justice O'Connor heard Florida called for Al Gore, she exclaimed, "This is terrible," and walked away. Her husband, John, then explained she was upset because they had wanted to retire to Arizona, but had been waiting so that a Republican president could name a successor. In the end, she had nothing to worry about because it was the Supreme Court justices who chose the president of the United States. Well, we're joined on the phone right now by Nan Arron, the president of the Alliance for Justice, a public policy group that focuses, among other things, on the judicial nomination process, and James Swanson, who is senior fellow at the Cato Institute and editor of the Cato Institute's Supreme Court Review. And then, Arron, let's begin with you. What news do you have of the possibility of retirement of one or more Supreme Court justices and your thoughts on that?
Well, thank you first for having me on your show. I love it. Well, potential Supreme Court retirements are among the best-kept secrets in the nation. In fact, just last night, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was on the McNeil Air Show and was asked about retirement, and she shook her head no and said, "I haven't made up my mind yet." I have some sneaking suspicion that, in fact, she may have made up her mind either one way or another, but the fact is we really don't know. The most people say, though, as you have said earlier, that if this is going to happen, if there will be a retirement, it's most likely to happen this year. Otherwise, a president would have to wait 2 years because presidents don't like to name Supreme Court nominees during an election year. So if it's going to happen, it probably will happen this year, and some announcement should be forthcoming at the end of the month.
Well, I think Matt is right to suggest that
James
we don't
Swanson.
Know. I think a lot of Supreme Court watchers embarrass themselves and get themselves in trouble by trying to make grand predictions of what might happen. It's like watching the Kremlin during the height of the Cold War. None of us really knows what's going to happen. We look for little signs and clues. Certainly none of the justices need to retire. They're all intellectually able and fit. Justice Stevens, 83, seems like a man of 63 when he's on the bench. The Chief Justice is at the top of his game. So if there's going to be a retirement, it's not because any of the justices need to retire. It's because they would choose to. I might disagree, though, with the notion that it's impossible to fill a vacancy during an election year. We shouldn't assume that a president wouldn't make a nomination to fill a vacancy if there happens to be a retirement in the summer of 2004. It might be a little tougher, but there's no rule that says a vacancy can't be filled closer to election than not. But I really think we shouldn't assume that anyone is going. I think Time magazine made a big mistake a few weeks ago when they said a retirement is almost certain. I think the justices might surprise all of us, and none of them might retire this year.
Nan Aaron, you think that's a possibility?
Well, it's just so hard to tell. It really is. But the fact is we'll probably know within a couple of weeks what will happen. And we're certainly hoping that if there is a vacancy, that this president finds some way to transcend the politics of the day. So far, we have seen from this White House a whole slew of extremist nominees, from Pickering to Priscilla Owen to Carolyn Kuhl. And tomorrow, we have a hearing on a nominee to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. That circuit covers Florida, Georgia, Alabama. This nominee is William Pryor, and he is among the most dangerous nominees we have seen yet from this administration. So I would say in terms of a Supreme Court vacancy, if there is one, we would certainly hope that President Bush picks a moderate, consensus, fair-minded candidate. If he does, that person will be easily confirmed. If he nominates an individual like the kinds of that are who similar to his Court of Appeals appointees, then he will be provoking a titanic battle in this country.
James Swanson, your response to even tomorrow's...
Well, one person's extremist is another person's mainstream judge. I think it's really the left and not the president that has politicized the whole nomination process. I think it's really time to stop playing politics with America's judges and courts, which is what a minority of senators has been doing for the last 2 years as President Bush has filled lower court appointments. What's happening is nominees are sitting for up to 2 years and not even getting a vote on the Senate floor. It's only fair to give each and every nominee an up or down vote. You can vote yes or you can vote no, but give each man or woman a vote. Suffice it to say, the vast majority of President Bush's nominees to the federal courts have been superbly qualified. Most of them have received the highest possible endorsement from the American Bar Association. Many of them have received endorsements from all seven living solicitor generals, who include several important Democrats.
So I think what we're seeing now in the politicization of the lower court nominees is a campaign by a minority of senators to politicize the court and to prevent any Bush Supreme Court nomination. The plan has been laid, the fundraising is happening, the commercials are starting to be filmed. A minority of senators and the left are really treating this possibility of a Supreme Court vacancy as an outright political campaign. And I really think that hurts nominees, it hurts the process, it hurts the courts, and it hurts the American people.
Oh, I just couldn't disagree more. The fact is that this Senate has confirmed over 120 judges. To our way of thinking, that's already too many. They're only stopping two at the moment. So if anything, this Senate has given President Bush what he wants, which is the vast majority of his judges.
In a way,
it's just so hypocritical for people to make a statement that the left is politicizing this. Let's just look back to the Clinton years, 8 years of centrist judges put forth by President Clinton with the explicit endorsement of Orrin Hatch. And even yet, even though these nominees were centrist, accomplished people, Republicans targeted them. They attacked them. And in fact, because they were so centrist, Republicans didn't even want them to have hearings because they would be revealed as individuals who were very worthy of becoming federal court judges. So what did the Republicans do? They blocked them. They denied them hearings. And of course, in that very awful day when Ronnie White, a African-American candidate to a district court seat in Missouri, was voted down, I can't think of a more political act on the part of the Senate. The Democrats have acted responsibly, have confirmed the overwhelming number of judges, and in a small number of cases, they have said enough is enough. These people are just too dangerous to become federal judges.
Well, can I mention a few things? First, during the first 2 years of the Bush presidency, it was the Senate Judiciary Committee under Senator Leahy who made several of the best appellate court nominees in history wait 2 years for a hearing. And I'd like to just name one of these so-called extremists. There's a fellow named Miguel Estrada in Washington, D.C., who was nominated by President Bush 2 years ago in May. This man has never been given a hearing. The American Bar Association decided it knew enough about him to give him the highest possible rating. He's argued dozens of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, all living former solicitor generals, including two Democrats, Walter Dellinger and Seth Waxman, have said it's wrong to ask for confidential memos that the Justice Department doesn't want to surrender regarding him. He's one of the best appellate court nominees in history, and yet he was made to wait 2 years. These are people who want to serve their country. It's unfair, it's even indecent to torture them and hang them out to dry without an up or down vote in the Senate. And the president is not demanding that every nominee be confirmed. The president is merely asking the courtesy and civility of saying yes or no. Vote up or down. Don't leave someone hanging for 6 months, a year, 2 years. Imagine applying for a job, having the interview, if you're lucky enough to get it, because many of these nominees haven't, and then being told, well, we'll get back to you in 6 months, a year, 2 years. It's simply not fair. It's a wrong way to politicize the process. If a minority of senators and other people don't like a nominee, say so and vote against him. Don't deny them even a simple vote.
Estrada was given a hearing. I was there. It was a day-long hearing.
He was given a hearing.
The problem was Estrada refused to answer questions. He refused to identify the three cases from the last 40 years of Supreme Court jurisprudence with which he most disagreed and to explain his selection. Now, what is the problem with answering that question? He was asked to identify judges, living or dead, whom he admires and would emulate on the bench. He refused to answer that question. He would not share his views on the environment, workers' rights, consumer rights, choice. You know, judges are just so powerful and make such important decisions that affect our lives. It would have been a scandal to confirm an individual to the D.C. Circuit, the second most important court in the country, without knowing more about where this individual stands on issues of the day. It's too important. It's not like an executive branch appointment. It's not like Ari Fleischer. This judges are powerful. They're there for life. And therefore, they have an obligation to tell us what they think before we vote on them. It's that simple.
Well, it's actually quite complicated because many of these questions really are political questions. They seek to know more than should be known. And I think that's because often the left seeks to politicize our courts. When all law becomes politics, there is no law.
What's political?
Often what causes they can't win through democracy in the legislature, they seek to impose on the rest of us through the courts. I think the left tends to view judges as political actors, not neutral judges. And that's why there's an intensive inquiry about political views on issues. And regarding the specifics of Miguel Estrada, we could debate all day what he did or didn't answer. But I think he answered hundreds of questions. Certainly, he was clear enough for the ABA, the American Bar Association, to give its highest endorsement. In fact,
the ABA investigation was conducted by Fred Fielding. Fred Fielding was a lawyer who was responsible to George Bush for several of his transition programs and policies.
Well, it's my understanding that a committee of the ABA makes its evaluation.
So let's not talk about the American Bar Association.
Well, 2 years ago, when
their
President...
work on this in this regard was fairly appalling. But let's look at what's happening today and tomorrow. Today there is a press conference in D.C. Where groups, environmental organizations, the AFL-CIO, NARAL, Planned Parenthood, People for the American Way, Leadership Conference, and our organization, the Alliance for Justice, will in unison announce opposition to the nomination of William Pryor. It's at 1:30 this afternoon. His hearing is tomorrow. And I'm hoping that people who listen to your program, Amy, follow what happens over the next several days and weeks, both with William Pryor and with the Supreme Court.
We're talking to Nan Aaron, President of the Alliance for Justice, as well as James Swanson, Senior Fellow of the Cato Institute. James Swanson, I just wanted to ask you a question, the point made at the beginning of this discussion about the Supreme Court justices and whether you're concerned about that comment of Sandra Day O'Connor being very upset when Gore was announced as president because she and her husband wanted to retire to Arizona, at least according to Newsweek, saying this is terrible. Her husband explaining upset because she wanted to retire to Arizona but had been waiting so a Republican president could name a successor. And then the Supreme Court justices ending up being the ones to select the president.
Well, when you use the word select, you imply a political decision and a political choice. First of all, regarding the alleged O'Connor statement, I don't know if it's true or not. You know, one thing we've learned recently in the news is certainly don't believe everything we read. And certainly, you know how rumors get started. So I'm not prepared to even say I know whether that statement was true or not. Second, if it is true that a justice might have expressed a desire to retire, what's wrong with that? Furthermore, it's generally a tradition of the court that justices seek to retire, all things being equal, under the party that appointed them.
Right. No, I totally understand that. But the issue that then the Supreme Court justices intervened in the election and they chose the president. What word would you use?
They didn't intervene. I think it's a misconception to think of it that way. It suggests that the court went out and intervened in a case.
Well, they
can't choose it. The court can only hear cases that are brought to it.
So what word would you use if you don't like that they chose the president? What word would you use?
On judicial review, they determined the appropriateness of certain actions by the Florida Supreme Court and the Secretary of State in the certification of the election. Yes, the result of that decision was President Bush won, but I assure you the Supreme Court didn't sit around and say, all right, we've got to have Bush win. Now let's figure out how to make it happen.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up the discussion. I want to thank you very much for being with us, James Swanson of the Cato Institute and Nan Aaron of the Alliance for Justice. Folks, if you want to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, and an O'Gara, Sharif Abdel Kaddous. I want to thank Vilka Tsouris and Noah Reibel. Mike DeFilippo and Rich Kim are our engineers. Elizabeth Press also produced today's show. I'm Amy Goodman. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
What I am raising is, what is the problem if indeed there has been a manipulation of intelligence? And if there has, we have everything from the possibility of a criminal offense, because it can be a conspiracy to defraud the government, something else that's a lasting lesson of Watergate, and it could be an impeachable offense.
Today, a conversation with John Dean, Richard Nixon's formal counsel, who went to prison for obstruction of justice. Dean says Bush should be impeached if he misled the American public on weapons of mass destruction. And we talked to reporters at the Washington Post and London Independent over the emerging crises on both sides of the Atlantic as the Bush and Blair administrations face mounting questions over whether they doctored evidence to push their countries to invade Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A top leader from Hamas has been wounded in an assassination attempt by Israeli forces. Agence France-Presse reports Israeli helicopter gunships fired missiles this morning at a car driven by Abdul Aziz Al-Rantisi in Gaza City. A five-year-old girl and a woman were killed. 25 others were injured. The attack comes at a particularly sensitive time, as Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen is attempting to bring Hamas back to the negotiating table in order to implement the U.S.-backed so-called roadmap to peace. The BBC is reporting it was Al-Rantisi who last week announced Hamas was withdrawing from the talks with Abu Mazen. Hamas has said one of the conditions it demanded to halt violence was an end to Israeli-targeted killings. A senior aide to Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, Nabil Abu Ndella, told Reuters today, quote, "This is a grave step. This shows Israel's determination to abort the roadmap." Israeli forces also destroyed 13 homes in the northern Gaza town of Beit Hanun. The move comes 2 days after the three main Palestinian militant groups joined forces to an attack an Israeli army outpost in the Gaza Strip, killing four Israeli soldiers. A fifth Israeli soldier was killed in a second attack on the West Bank. It was the first Palestinian attack since the Prime Minister Abu Mazen met with Israeli Prime Minister Sharon and President Bush for the peace summit in Jordan. Abu Mazen is facing fierce criticism from certain sectors of Palestinian groups for giving too much while demanding too little. Meanwhile, The Guardian of London reports Israeli settlers continue to protest against Ariel Sharon's decision to dismantle illegal Jewish outposts in the West Bank, at least some of them. In Amona, hundreds of settlers attempted to block Israeli soldiers from tearing down homes there. While Sharon has announced plans to dismantle 15 outposts, only four of them are inhabited. The Associated Press is reporting that the U.S. military units assigned to track down Iraqi weapons of mass destruction have run out of places to look and are getting time off or being assigned to other duties. Lieutenant Colonel Keith Harrington, whose team has been cut by more than 30%, said, quote, "It doesn't appear there are any more targets at this time. We're hanging around with no missions in the foreseeable future," he said. AP reports over the past week, several teams have been taken off assignment completely. Rather than visit suspected weapon sites, they're brushing up on target practice and catching up on writing letters home. The Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency is expected to be sent in to take over the inspector's jobs once its 1,300-person Iraq survey group takes over. This comes as pressure mounts on President Bush to explain why no banned weapons have been found. For the second time in recent days, Bush said yesterday, quote, he was absolutely convinced that the U.S. would find proof that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, is reporting the number of children in Iraq suffering from diarrhea and related diseases appears to have risen dramatically in the past year. Cholera, dysentery, and typhoid are 2.5 times higher this May than a year earlier. The World Food Program said that before the U.S.-led invasion, 1 million Iraqi children had been malnourished as a result of diarrhea. But the war and the collapse of Iraq's infrastructure has worsened the health hazards, disrupting clean water supplies, damaging sewage systems, and halting rubbish collections. North Korea threatened yesterday to build nuclear weapons as a deterrent to what it calls, quote, hostile U.S. policy. The Associated Press reports it was the government's first public declaration of its nuclear ambitions. North Korea also, for the first time, linked its nuclear efforts to rebuilding its failing economy. Three U.S. immigration agents were convicted yesterday of violating the civil rights of a Mexican immigrant who died after his neck was broken in a 2001 INS raid in Texas. Serafin Olivera Carrera, a 48-year-old father of five, was handcuffed and forced to lie face down on the floor while one of the agents kneed him forcefully in the back, leaving him paralyzed. When Olivera complained, the agents thought he was faking his injury, and they proceeded to pepper spray him. He didn't receive treatment for 7 more hours. Three immigration officials now face up to 20 years in prison. The White House is urging House Republicans to increase the child tax credit for 6.5 million low-income families. This comes following a heated dispute over the omission of the poor in the tax bill that Bush signed last month. The FBI yesterday oversaw the draining of a Maryland pond in a search for evidence in the 2001 anthrax attacks. The pond is located 8 miles from Fort Detrick. That's the military site where bioterrorism expert Stephen Hatfill used to work. Hatfill's been identified by officials as a, quote, person of interest in the case. He has denied any involvement. And Usman Zango, the African immigrant shot dead by a plainclothes New York City police officer, was buried in his native country of Burkina Faso yesterday. Zango was remembered as someone who had tried to provide for his family and others in his village, sending money for books, medicines, and food. The funeral was attended by Usman Zango's wife, children, and other family members. Zango was shot 4 times on May 22nd by a New York City police officer who was guarding counterfeit merchandise seized during a raid on a warehouse in Manhattan. Zango was unarmed. He had been visiting a rented storage unit where he repaired African craftwork and drums. He was shot after a winding chase through the facility's hallways. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office is investigating the shooting. It remains unclear why the chase began.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand?
Is It for Freedom? Sarah Thompson here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. military units assigned to hunt for Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction are receiving time off and are being assigned to other duties. Why? According to the Associated Press, they've run out of places to look. Over the past week, several U.S. teams searching for weapons have been taken off assignment completely. They're writing letters home and brushing up on target practice. Colonel Keith Harrington's team has been cut by more than 30%. As I said in the headlines, he told the AP, quote, "It doesn't appear there are any more targets at this time." He said, "We're hanging around with no missions in the foreseeable future." The weapons inspectors say they're now waiting for a large team of Pentagon intelligence experts to take over the effort. This comes as the controversy over why no weapons of mass destruction have been found in Iraq has reached the boiling point on both sides of the Atlantic. Time and again, President Bush, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of State General Colin Powell, and British Prime Minister Tony Blair drummed the same message home. Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. They told the American people this. They told the British people this. They told Arab states this. They told the U.S. Congress, the British Parliament, and the U.N. Security Council this. It was all to justify the invasion of a sovereign nation. But now, 2 months after U.S. tanks rolled into Baghdad, no weapons have been found. No evidence of weapons has even been found. Meanwhile, a series of intelligence leaks and anonymous interviews with intelligence officers indicate the White House may have overstated its own evidence. The Washington Post reported Saturday an internal report by the Defense Intelligence Agency found there was, quote, "no reliable information on whether Iraq is producing or stockpiling chemical weapons or whether Iraq has or will establish its chemical agent production facilities." We're going to be joined by reporters Walter Pincus of the Washington Post and Kim Sengupta of the London Independent in a minute. But first, we want to play an excerpt from yesterday's White House press briefing with Ari Fleischer. It begins with a question from a reporter.
Ari, I just wanted to ask a question about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. In his radio address on October 5th, President Bush clearly said Iraq has stockpiled biological and chemical weapons. But in a Defense Intelligence Agency report from September 2002, the DIA stated there is no reliable information on whether Iraq is producing and stockpiling chemical weapons. Just wondering how you reconcile those two disparate thoughts, and where did the president get the intelligence that indeed Iraq was stockpiling chemical weapons?
From that same report and from other reports. You're reading one sentence from the report. As you know, if you read the rest of the report, it's been declassified. You have the summary of it. It talks about how Iraq is distributing chemical weapon munitions.
It also uses the word suggests that Iraq is distributing.
That's correct.
Definitive in a statement.
That's correct, and that's because it's based on an amalgam of all the intelligence information that's available, not one sentence. And when you look at the totality of the information that was available and from the intelligence community to the president, he said that because that's the conclusion that not only did the CIA reach in 2003, but it's consistent with the reporting that was done by the intelligence communities going back to the early, mid, late 90s.
So you're saying he had other intelligence other than the DIA?
Well, of course, the president has multiple forms of intelligence that he looks at. And when you take a look at it in its totality, it supports just what the president said.
So did he consider that other intelligence to be more valuable than the DIA intelligence?
It looks at it as we've always talked about intelligence being a mosaic, different pieces. Some of those pieces are more clear than other pieces. Some of those pieces are less clear than other pieces. The job of the analyst is to add it up, make recommendations to the policymakers, and the president made his conclusions and shared them with the public. Not only this president, the previous presidents.
Well, why didn't the president err on the side of conservatism and take the DIA report over the other intelligence that got him?
First of all, the president...
I mean, he seemed to take a worst-case scenario.
The president didn't err on one side or another. He focused on accuracy. And based it on the combined assessments of the intelligence community from all its different forms, as was done in the case of others. Now, that's why the president said it. It was based on what he had heard from a variety of the different sources in the intelligence community. When you add it all up, it was clear, and the president said it.
That's White House press spokesperson Ari Fleischer speaking to reporters yesterday at the White House. On the line with us, Walter Pincus, national security reporter for The Washington Post, who's written several articles on the administration's weapons of mass destruction claims over the past week. Can you go through them with us, Walter Pincus, and also respond to Ari Fleischer's discussion of WMDs?
Well, I think he... pretty well stated what is today the administration's position. What we have tried to do all the way through this is reflect the fact that they have not had, the administration and the community itself has not had hard information as to, for example, where chemical or biological weapons were located or even where the stockpiles were located. What they have done throughout this is to take pieces, which they call mosaics, and weave them together. And whereas in most of the cases, almost all cases, with the information, they use words like suggest or maybe, appear to be. But in some of the summaries, they change that to the active word are. And the administration over the past year and a half has, in various statements, gone further than the inferences that come about from the intelligence they have.
You also reported on Vice President Dick Cheney's repeated visits to the CIA and the pressure that Iraq analysts felt there.
What you have is in a very unusual set of visits, because the Vice President of the United States in the past has not taken as active an interest, at least outside the White House, in intelligence. Dick Cheney was on the Intelligence Committee when he was in Congress. He has shown great interest. He has sort of more foreign policy advisors in his own immediate office than Vice Presidents have normally had. And he is an influential voice. And one of the things he's done is to take himself out to the agency, not just on the Iraq matter, but to question analysts on other matters. Now, depending on who the analysts are, and to some degree, a little bit I found out about it, depending on their experience, some felt they were pressured. Others didn't. Others were quite pleased that they had a direct line to the vice president and could state their views. But there's no doubt that some felt pressure by being asked pointed questions about their findings and believe there was pressure, although even some of those people say that it didn't influence their ultimate findings. The analysts didn't change their views. But it's also clear in summary, at least in the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate, the flat statement was made that Iraq possesses biological and chemical weapons, although the backup material made public, at least, did carry the traditional adjectives that appear to have, may have, and things like that.
We're talking to Walter Pincus of The Washington Post. We're breaking, and then we'll come back with him, as well as Kin Sen Gupta of The Independent of London. He'll talk about what Tony Blair has been saying about weapons of mass destruction. Stay with us.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, and now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we looked swell. Full of that Yankee doodle-dee-dum.
Abby Lincoln singing Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Lyrics by Yip Harburg. Here on Democracy Now!, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. Tony Blair.
I stand absolutely 100% behind the evidence based on intelligence that we presented to people. And let me just make one or two things clear. Firstly, the idea that we doctored intelligence reports in order to invent some notion about a 45-minute capability of delivering weapons of mass destruction, the idea that we doctored such intelligence is completely and totally false. Every single piece of intelligence that we presented was cleared very properly by the Joint Intelligence Committee. Secondly, the idea, as apparently Claire Short is saying, that I made some secret agreement with George Bush back last September that we would invade Iraq in any event at a particular time is also completely and totally untrue.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair addressing questions about whether the government manufactured or overstated the evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Our guests are Walter Pincus of The Washington Post and Kim Sengupta of The Independent of London. Kim Sengupta, can you talk about the controversy that is growing in Britain?
Well, interestingly, about 4 hours ago, we had the annual report of the House of Commons Intelligence Security Committee, which is the parliamentary watchdog on intelligence by elected members of parliament. And they have officially censured Downing Street, the Prime Minister, for the second report, which came out in February. In their section on Iraq, they say, although the document did contain some intelligence, derived material was not clearly attributed or highlighted amongst the other material, nor was it checked with the agency providing the intelligence or cleared by the JIC, the JIC being the Joint Intelligence Committee, the umbrella group for our various intelligence agencies in Britain. Prior to publication, we have been assured that system have now been put in place to ensure this cannot happen again, in that the JIC chairman endorses any material or on behalf of the intelligence community prior to publication, which coming from the parliamentary committee, which is predominantly made up of MPs from the ruling Labour Party, is pretty interesting stuff.
What is the response of the British public right now?
Well, it's one at, I think it began with one of interest, then skepticism about the government, endless cartoons, you know, WMD standing for weapons of mass deception, of mass destruction, of mass distrust, etc. and a belief that they had been misled, if not lied to. And also a feeling that even if the Americans and the British forces now do discover WMDs in Iraq, the feeling would be they have been planted. But having said that, you know, this thing has been rumbling on now for the last, almost 3 to 4 weeks in its present form. And now it's going down to minutiae of who said what to who or when, and was this doctored, was this not. So from the macro level, from the Republic, I think very soon now you are going to get a certain level of indifference.
That's not how we lead into it. You were talking to Kim Semgupta, independent of London, and Walter Pincus of the Washington Post. Walter Pincus, what about the differences between how the British public and the government in Britain is responding versus here in the United States?
As you just heard, the Labour Party, which is the majority party, has members who are quite active and quite vocal in their opposition. Right now in the United States, the Congress is relatively quiet. And Democrats, although some have raised questions, essentially it's been clear questions about how the intelligence ought to be looked at, how it ought to be measured, and the normal cry for congressional investigation. But you don't have the same public grouping in this country that you do have in Parliament in London. I think Tony Blair is paying right now a much bigger price than this administration. And I think everybody has to realize that the search is not over. The size of the force of weapons of mass destruction that existed prior to the war may have been much smaller if it had not all been destroyed by the time the war started. But some things may exist, and gradually you're seeing the administration turn from finding shells and rockets and stocks, which they hinted may exist. Not hinted, they said very boldly existed in various speeches. They've now moved to saying there were programs and there was equipment and things were ready to go at a later date. And that's quite a switch.
What about the issue that the U.S. government will not allow in U.N. weapons inspectors? The U.S. is now pulling back their inspection team by 30%. They've gone to all the sites they say they can go to and going to put in the Pentagon's, the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, will be sending in people to take over. The credibility there, that if they don't find them, if this grows in this presidential year, the controversy, that they'll put them there. Who would stop them from doing that?
I think people are speculating on that, and I think they ought to just wait and see. First of all, the group that's going in for the first time is not totally a DIA group. It was essentially a military group that they had up to now. The group that's going in now, the Iraqi Survey Group, is one much larger and actually contains, I think, up to a dozen former United Nations inspectors who are Americans, all of whom had at least 10 previous trips to Iraq. They're much better prepared than the total military group that went in sort of as the war took place. So, in fact, the replacements are probably more qualified to handle this than the group that's coming out, and it's much larger. It's the weapons inspectors per se may be a little larger, but they have many more analysts, and they're looking into to sort of measure the intelligence. So the group going in, although it's under the command of the deputy director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, is a much broader group than existed before. And they're keeping the notion that they would plant things, I think, you'll have to wait and see. It goes to the old argument. There had to be hundreds of people involved in something like that.
Ken Sengupta, what about this issue of credibility at this point? As the situation gets more desperate for the two administrations, Blair and Bush, as the outcry grows, the credibility issue of whether these weapons could be manufactured or put there?
Well, I think Walter is right in the sense that Tony Blair faces a more intrinsic immediate crisis than President Bush does, mainly because the support for a war in this country was always significantly less than on your side on across the Atlantic. It's a problem for Tony Blair because he portrays himself as a very moral person, a very moral leader. This is a crusade, just as Afghanistan was. You know, it's painted in terms of good versus evil. So if you have got a situation where you are accused of misleading the public, and constitutionally a more serious matter of misleading Parliament, then it does him no good at all, even if politically he survives. And I don't think he will survive. You know, there is no effective opposition in Britain at the moment, and I think you've got to be incredibly melodramatic to think this will actually bring down Tony Blair. But I think what it will do is damage his credibility, damage his perception he's tried to build up as a moral leader, as someone who believes in principles. If it, we have already had a linkage between distortion and doctoring of intelligence documents to some of his closest aides, people like Alistair Campbell. Now, if this extends to the Prime Minister himself, then he is obviously facing severe problems. But I should point out that has not happened yet. There's been no claim that he ordered distortion to or embellishment to take place himself personally. As far as whether the Americans plant things, I mean, of the last 9 months, I've spent the last six in Iraq. I was dating the war, and I met the Americans when they come in. My personal view is they're not going to do that. I have faith in their honesty in that, and the same with the British forces. But whether the public would be convinced is a different matter.
Walter Pincus, as a longtime reporter for The Washington Post, I was wondering if you could comment on your colleagues at The New York Times. Yes, they're going through a major crisis right now. But one of the issues that's been raised is they talk about their 152-year low being around this young reporter who fabricated stories. An issue that's been raised is perhaps it is a 152-year low, but for their drumbeat coverage for war led by Judith Miller. And her main thrust in article after exclusive article of unnamed sources was the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And the Washington Post has exposed an email between John Burns, the New York Times reporter, and Judith Miller, his colleague, challenging the unnamed sources, and turns out it's Ahmed Chalabi, who has his own reasons for wanting, you know, the Iraqi National Congress leader. What about this, and what about this push around the issue of weapons of mass destruction? Do you think this should be challenged? Do you think she should be fired?
Well, I don't know. I make it a habit because I write essentially in intelligence and investigative matters, really not to comment on what other people do. We all have our own standards. I probably use unnamed sources more than anybody else. And to me, what people don't realize is if you're using an anonymous source, you really check it out twice as hard as you do somebody who puts their name to it. So we're all very careful, and we all, in our own way, try to do the best we can. The one thing sort of half correct you on, I think two of the most controversial of Judy Miller's pieces, both were at contributed to the Iraqi National Congress, which made us wary of them in the first place. But in other words, not all of her stories come from anonymous sources. This has been a difficult thing to report on. You really have to trust your sources, particularly people in the intelligence field who can't be quoted. And what you get is the official statements coming out, and then you try to check them the best you can, and normally you can only do it with anonymous sources. I wrote a piece, I guess, 3 days before the war started saying that the administration evidence of the existence of weapons of mass destruction was thin, and that twice I wrote that Secretary Powell's statements were inferential. A lot of the intelligence he used, things like people talking to each other and mentioning the word nerve agents or pictures showing what purport to be trucks and vehicles only used in connection with those types of weapons, still are inferential. And that's, if you go back and reread his statement, I think it's only one time when he talked about the size of the stocks, which was always a danger because every time they talked to the stocks and the UN and Chief Inspector Hans Blix, his statement was that these were stocks that the Iraqis had never proven they had destroyed, but he never said they existed. They were the irony of the current situation is this administration repeatedly said it was not up to the inspectors to find weapons. It was up to Saddam Hussein to prove that he didn't have them. Well, now that situation is totally reversed. It's now, I think, being asked of this administration to prove that they did exist. And I think proving they did exist will be as difficult as proving Saddam Hussein, proving that they didn't. So we'll see what happens. But I mean, we're just in kind of the early mid stage of this whole effort.
It also depends on how much the mainstream media in this country, led by newspapers like yours, the Washington Post and the New York Times, really on front page drumbeat coverage, the same way you've done on the invasion, pursue this issue of whether the president lied and his administration. Well, we're going to turn now to John Dean, the former counsel to President Nixon, who was imprisoned for obstruction of justice, who has written a very interesting piece around the issue of if President Bush lied, is it worse than Watergate? We want to thank Kimsum Gupta of the Independent of London and Walter Pincus of the Washington Post. We'll be back in a minute.
Why should I be standing in his line, waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Why us in khaki suits. You know, brother, we sure look swell.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to John Dean, the counsel to President Nixon. On June 17, 1972, five men employed by CREEP, the Committee to Elect President, were arrested while breaking into the Democratic National Headquarters at the Watergate Hotel to plant listening devices in the phones and steal campaign strategy documents. Two former White House aides working for CREEP, G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, were also arrested. Liddy was a former FBI agent, Hunt with the CIA. In February 1973, the Senate established the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities to investigate the water break-in. White House Presidential Counsel John Dean resigned on April 30th, 1973, admitting to taking part in the cover-up of the burglary. Interestingly, he is now writing about whether if, in fact, the weapons of mass destruction are not found, if, in fact, President Bush lied, could he be impeached? And was that crime worse than Watergate? We put the question to him.
Well, I wrote the piece in Find Law because I had been following the story of missing weapons of mass destruction. And as somebody who was deeply involved in Watergate and quite aware of the fact that Watergate really put every president who has followed Nixon on notice that you cannot misuse and abuse the agencies of government, I was very curious to know if indeed the intelligence agencies of the federal government had been somehow misused or abused to get the conclusion that there were weapons of mass destruction. We don't know the answer to that. And I make that very clear. I don't know the answer to that. But what I am raising is, what is the problem if indeed there has been a manipulation of intelligence? And if there has, we have everything from the possibility of a criminal offense, because it can be a conspiracy to defraud the government, something else that's a lasting lesson of Watergate, and it could be an impeachable offense. Now, there's no such thing as the law of impeachment. There really is only the political practice, but I'm just saying that this would certainly come within the parameters of a high crime and misdemeanor to bring a nation to war based on false information.
What is the information, as you understand it, about weapons of mass destruction, what the Bush administration, what President Bush himself said along the way, and why that matters?
Well, very clearly, Mr. Bush has made countless statements. Rather than reciting them all, for example, in his radio address, I'll give you some of the declarative ones that stick in my memory. In his radio address back in October of last year, he said Iraq had stockpiled biological and chemical weapons and that they were rebuilding their nuclear weapon facilities. Then again, he gave a very lengthy speech in Cincinnati in October of last year, where he again made very declarative statements. He said the Iraq regime possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. There was just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It was just a very matter-of-fact declarative statement that they existed. And he got down to the specifics that included mustard gas and VX nerve gas, and he had some other specifics. And then shortly before he took the nation to war, he said that, based on the intelligence that this country and other governments had, that there was just no doubt that the Iraq regime possessed and was actively concealing what he called the most lethal weapons ever devised. When he asked for a joint resolution from the Congress to go to war, he also supplied in the whereas clause a number of very specific statements that made it very clear that there such weapons existed, or he had intelligence that such weapons existed. Now, today I read in the Washington Post, for example, that he made a statement that he now says, he said that Iraq has had a program of weapons, that they had a, what I think his exact phrase was, Iraq had a weapons program. Well, I don't think anybody denies they had a weapons program. That's certainly would be a lot of fun to have a witness like that on the stand to cross-examine him.
So if Bush actually lied, and do you think he did, what should happen to him?
Well, I don't know if Bush lied. Lying is a matter of one's intent. It's an intentional falsehood. It does appear that some of his statements are false. Whether he knew they were false or not, I don't know the answer to that. There are some that of his supporters who are already starting to back off and say, well, we're not so sure there were weapons of mass destruction, even though we thought that was an awfully good possibility, and we think that Bush should back off a little bit. Well, he doesn't seem to be willing to do so unless you take his declarative statements of earlier and now his statements that they had a program, which is a huge difference, as really basically a concession that he had made false statements. I don't think he's prepared to go that far. So I don't know that he's lied. I can't, that the evidence isn't all in yet. And the other thing is the administration keeps saying that they are going to continue, and indeed I assume they will, because it's quite important they do so, to see if they can't find the weapons of mass destruction. So many people are saying quite appropriately, we've got to wait and see what happens.
In the piece that you wrote, and you say there are two main possibilities. One, that something's wrong with the Bush White House's national security operations, and you say that's difficult to believe. The other is that the president has deliberately misled the nation and the world.
Those are two options, exactly. And we don't know what the answer to those questions are. The evidence is certainly strongly suggesting that Mr. Bush has made misrepresentations. He's taken us to war on a bogus premise, and that would be very unfortunate if he has.
And if he has, what should happen to him?
Well, if he has, I think, first of all, let's look at the big picture. If he's got bad intelligence and he says, well, listen, I only repeated what I was told, we're in trouble, because his entire preemptive foreign policy is based on knowing what other nations are doing and the desire to stop them from doing it before they do it. That really would shake to the roots his preemptive foreign policy and be a real reason for caution before anybody would pursue it. Let's say he's caught himself, somebody is able to put the lie to him with what other evidence that might surface. Then you've got a possibility of, one, did he manipulate an agency to do so? I don't know if he did or not. If he did not and just got bad intelligence, he can probably point the finger at somebody else. But from what I gather from my friends in Washington, a lot of those in the intelligence community are just not going to let him point the finger because they don't believe that's the case. They think that there was some manipulation. But the other thing is, this is a political question as well. Certainly if it ever were to go to impeachment, you've got to have a fairly hostile atmosphere before that will happen. We're a long way from that. But I think his credibility is going to be seriously damaged if indeed he's caught in a serious lie.
John Dean, is this, if he is caught in a serious lie, worse than Watergate?
Well, it depends upon what the lie is. Nixon was clearly caught in many lies. He lied about his role in Watergate and the cover-up, and he did it for a protracted period of time. We're very early right now. We don't know how this is all going to play out, and I don't have a crystal ball, and my tea leaves aren't that good, so I can't tell you what's going to happen. I just know that I think right now, this president has a very serious credibility problem, and he might be well advised to call a blue ribbon panel in to look at the evidence and make its own independent conclusion as to whether he was justified in taking the position he was.
John Dean, in a previous piece that you've written, you take on Vice President Dick Cheney. He goes back to the Nixon White House, as you do. And you say, not since Richard Nixon's presidency have the powers of Congress been in greater jeopardy. Can you talk about Dick Cheney then and now?
Well, I Dick Cheney then and now, first of all, Cheney was at the Nixon White House. I didn't know him. He was working for Don Rumsfeld. And then when Nixon left, of course, Rumsfeld would have ultimately become chief of staff and then Cheney chief of staff. I have not really sifted through a lot of his background to know what some of his earlier positions were, but I do know he has declared publicly on a number of occasions he'd like to turn the clock back to pre-Watergate. I'm not so sure that's very healthy. I think we learned a lot from Watergate that hopefully we wouldn't just dispose of by turning the clock back. One of the things that Cheney has been very adamant about, and what I've written a number of those pieces about, were the fact he insists upon a secrecy, which really, I think, was pretty fully discredited by Watergate, the dangers of secrecy. And yet he would have us go back to a very sort of secret, almost Cold War atmosphere where no one can question what the White House and the president are doing. In fact, Cheney has been so adamant about it, when the General County Office asked for information about his energy task force, he said, well, listen, I'm not going to give it to you. If you want to try to sue me, I don't think you can. And he was right. They sued him. He won in a very twisted and, to me, distorted ruling by a judge who had just been appointed by Bush. And by the time it got up to the potential for appealing it, the Republicans had regained control of the Congress, and the Republican Congress told the controller, who works basically for the Congress, don't appeal it. So we right now have a situation where there's some really gray areas as to what kind of oversight the Congress even has over the president and vice president.
Why do you believe that Cheney is the force behind the White House's effort to enhance presidential power and limit the powers of Congress?
I suspect one of the reasons that Cheney feels the way he does is he was sitting there at the White House at the time that many of the changes that opened up the executive branch, and when the Congress was flexing its muscle in the aftermath of Watergate, and he seems to have never gotten over it. For example, President Ford, who was a fairly open man and amiable and had just come really basic from the Congress, when a new amendment to the Freedom of Information Act arrived in 1974, just shortly after Ford had assumed office, somebody whispered in Ford's ear, you should veto this thing. And he did, and the veto was overridden overwhelmingly, because the whole thrust of government was going the other way. Another thing that Cheney probably has never gotten over is the War Powers Act, which he didn't like at all. And so he seems to be trying to turn the clock back to reverse all that progressive legislation that happened when we learned something from the mistakes made during the Nixon presidency.
John Dean, this is a side issue, but I was just wondering, you write that Dick Cheney joined the Nixon administration in 1969, serving in a number of positions at the Cost of Living Council and later the Office of Economic Opportunity. When President Nixon was looking for to count the Jews in the Bureau of Labor, was it the Bureau of Labor Statistics or Labor Management?
One or the other.
Was Cheney a part of that?
I don't think so. I don't think that was over in that shop, not to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was Fred Malik he had.
Yes, Fred Malik, but I was wondering if Cheney was there also.
No, well, Cheney was there, but not in that was a different compartment in all those many. There are roughly 120-some offices within the executive office of the president.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of shops.
You also mentioned that the reason you think Cheney is the force behind the effort to enhance presidential power is simply that Bush simply doesn't possess the mental acumen or experience.
I suspect that's right. In watching George Bush, since he's ambled into the national spotlight, he seems to have little real understanding of the history of the presidency. He was around, yes, in and out when his father was in the office, but not much of a student of it. And I think he's got very limited knowledge of how it really operates, whereas Dick Cheney's just the opposite. He's intellectual, understands the way the presidency operates, and he knows it's a lot easier to govern when you don't have people looking over your shoulder.
How do you feel when, with the course of events and history playing out the way it has, here you went to jail for 4 months for obstruction of justice, and Rumsfeld and Cheney went on to become, well, major powers once again in a new White House?
Well, I technically didn't go to jail. I had 120 days in the witness protection program, but I did admit to a felony, no question, because I had been involved in one. They were not, so they didn't make the same mistakes I did, and more power to them.
Sorry, in your own PR, it says went to prison for 4 months.
Did I say that?
It's on your website.
Oh, okay. I'll have to correct that someday.
Usually you have people sort of making it look a little better. I'm not used to this going this way. In fact, John Dean did spend 4 months in jail, 127 days. He was charged with obstruction of justice. We're talking to John Dean, who is the former counsel to President Nixon, about whether President Bush should be impeached if, in fact, he lied about weapons of mass destruction. And the whole question of whether, if he did knowingly lie, whether that's worse than Watergate. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we continue with that interview with John Dean.
Really, if you look at the substance of the article I wrote, it's more a question of that I'm raising is if he has manipulated the information, if he has misused and abused the processes of government, then he's got a problem. I think we're all aware that presidents are often less than candid, particularly in the national security area. But in this instance, he really, if he has manipulated the information to persuade the nation to go to war, that's a pretty serious potential offense.
What about the press and all of this?
I'm going to have to give you about one more minute.
Okay. The press and all of this. In Britain, this is front page news every day. The idea that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and perhaps Blair and Bush well knew that. What about the coverage of this here?
Well, it's very interesting the way the press has picked up on this this issue more than others so far, where there have been really some serious questions about this administration. There are more questions coming up on this than I've seen in a long time. So while it's not quite as glaring and blaring as the United Kingdom press, which is, I think, obviously having an influence, because in a sense Blair is in a parallel situation to Bush, and he's taking a real beating over there because they're both members of his party and the opposition party, the Conservative Party and the Labor Party, both are raising questions. Here, we don't have much of a peep out of either the Democratic leadership or any of the Republican leadership. So that mutes it and makes it a little bit less of an issue here.
And 30 seconds, last question. Cheney going over to the CIA and multiple trips, this being exposed by Walter Pincus and Dana Priest of The Washington Post, repeatedly creating an environment which some analysts felt they were being pressured to make assessments that fit with the Bush administration's policy objectives. Do you feel that this harkens back to Nixon and what he was doing in the White House and the significance of this pressure?
To give you a very thumbnail description, I would say that's very Nixonian behavior.
And that was former Nixon counsel John Dean. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel, Volker Tsouras. Also, special thanks to Andrew Blackman and Jeannie Austin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening and watching another edition of Democracy Now!
Can you spare a dime?